From our nation's capital, this is Naps Chat.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of Naps Chat. I'm Bob Levy, the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the National Association of Postal Supervisors. Before I introduce this episode's guest, let me provide a bit of postal-related news. On May 29th, the Postal Service opened for comment proposed regulations to implement President Trump's executive order relating to mailed absentee ballots for federal elections. The proposed regulations would deem undeliverable certain absentee ballots whose recipients' addresses were not on a list already submitted to the Postal Service. Several federal lawsuits have already been filed challenging the legality and constitutionality of the underlying executive order and the Postal Service compliance with it. In addition, on June 4th, the House Subcommittee on Government Operations conducted a hearing at which all four members of the Postal Regulatory Commission testified. The hearing focused on the Postal Service's poor financial condition, diminished performance resulting from the Delivering for America plan, and the need to clarify and safeguard the Postal Service's universal service obligation. 2 days prior to the already scheduled hearing, Postmaster General Steiner sent a letter to the bipartisan leadership of the House and Senate postal-related committees in which he outlined his immediate legislative asks, which include, one, increasing the agency's borrowing authority from $15 billion to $34.5 billion, two, reforming and resuming the Postal Service's public service appropriation, an appropriation the Postal Service has not requested for the past 46 years, and three, diversifying the investments contained in the Postal Service's retirement trust fund. Interestingly, there was little reference to the letter at the congressional hearing. Now let me introduce my guest. Today I am honored and delighted to welcome Representative Steny Hoyer of Maryland to join me on Apps Chat. There is no member of Congress of whom I have more admiration, respect, and affection. Steny was first elected in 1981 and progressed through the House leadership, culminating as House Majority Leader for 8 years, and within the House leadership structure for most of his congressional career. Congressman Hoyer will be retiring from the House at the end of this year. I will personally miss his leadership, but I will always cherish his friendship. Welcome to Naps Chat, Steny.
Gee, Bob, with that introduction, I'm really glad to be with you. You are such a good friend, and your listeners ought to know you're not objective because you are such a good friend. So they can take that with a little bit of skepticism, but thank you very much.
As I mentioned in your introduction, you've served in the House of Representatives for about 45 years. In your view, how has the People's House changed over that time?
Pretty substantially, Bob. When I came to the House, first of all, Democrats have been in charge for a very significant period of time, well over a decade. And there was not a sense that every action that was taken would benefit the other side and therefore lessen your chances of taking over. There was a much more collegial relationship between the parties. And, of course, we had two people leading our parties when I came to the Congress that were salt-of-the-earth people who enjoyed one another's company, who respected one another, who differed on issues. Bob Michael of Illinois, from Peoria, Illinois, the center of the country, and Tip O'Neill from Massachusetts, a wonderful Irish politician, gregarious, and person everybody really liked. The two of them worked together, didn't always agree, and when they disagreed, they fought about issues. But they always respected one another, and that was the sense in the House. Now, when I came, it was the year that Reagan took office, and he had an agenda he wanted to pursue. And it became pretty partisan and pretty rough, and a number of our Democrats, in effect, voted with the Republicans on a number of issues, particularly fiscal issues and tax issues. But it was still a Congress that worked well together. That's not the case today. And we see a very partisan split in the Congress. We see a majority party that has a very, very slim majority and can't get work done a lot. And for whatever reasons, our speaker does not cross the aisle and say, okay, what can we do together? He waits until he can get things done with his people alone. And that's led, I think, to a Congress that is not nearly as collegial, cooperative, and bipartisan as the American people would like it to be.
Congressman, early in your career, you developed an expertise in the appropriations process and chaired its subcommittee with jurisdiction over the Postal Service. Appropriations is the congressional power of the purse. Could you talk about the importance of Congress and the power of the purse?
Well, I think that's a very, very, very timely question, because frankly, we now have an administration that has a director of OMB, a guy named Russell Vogt, who has as a premise that the Article 2 of the Constitution gives to the president almost plenary powers. That's not what the founders intended. What they created was a government where they wanted to have a check on the power of the executive. And the reason they wanted that, they'd gone through King George, and they'd gone through a royal government and royal prerogatives to do just about what the king wanted to do. And so they wrote a constitution and created a legislative body, which was unique in many ways because the upper body, or the different body, the other body as we call it, the Senate, has almost equal power with the House. Not equal power, but equal, but almost. And they created it as the Article I, as opposed to Article II, the executive department, because they believed that the direct representatives of the people ought to be superior to the executive, and that the executive was to do what the name implies, carry out the policies that the Congress adopts. And they created one body that had to be reelected every 2 years. Why? So it would stay very close to the voice of the people, would have to go back, in effect, to have their terms reaffirmed and the policies that they were pursuing on behalf of the constituents again looked at and either supported or not. And, of course, meaning they would elect a new representative, a different representative who would do something differently. So it was a very conscious choice by the founding fathers to limit pretty severely, particularly in fiscal matters and in war-making powers, the president's power. And so in fiscal policies, they, in effect, said no dollars should be spent other than by action of the Congress. And the Supreme Court, under the Impoundment Act, has ruled that it is unconstitutional for the president either not to spend money we have appropriated and directed as to how it may be spent, or to simply reduce the spending levels by himself. In other words, not just hold it back, but not spend it at all. That's not what this president has been doing. And it is a dangerous precedent that he is, when I say precedent, other presidents have tried to do this, and the Supreme Court of the United States says, you can't do that. The Congress appropriates money, and when it does so, that's the law, and it must be spent as directed. That prevents the president from being a dictator. But that does not prevent him from trying to be a dictator, frankly. And that's what I think this president is doing. And it's bad for the country, bad for democracy, and particularly we see a very irresponsible spending of money at this point in time. We're talking about ballrooms. We're talking about pools. We're talking about arches, none of which have been funded by the Congress, none of which have been considered by the Congress, and none of which our constituents have urged us to do. Now, the pool is a lesser thing because that's a painting of the bottom of the pool. The problem was not the color of the bottom. The problem is the bottom is leaking and the pipes feeding the pool are leaking. That's what needs to be worked on. But, of course, that's not very exciting. And the president has pursued a program that is dealing with aesthetics and show. Again, not surprising, but not with the substance of, that the problem is. So, bottom line is we're at an imbalance at this point in time.
Let me mention another Article I power that Congress has in the Constitution. That is the establishment of post offices and post roads, Article I, Section 8 of the Constitution. And you have had a longstanding interest in postal operations, particularly in Southern Maryland, and that is specifically the mail processing facility in Southern Maryland. I can recall years ago there were serious issues with that plant. While many members of Congress focus on mail delivery or retail locations, you focused on mail processing and delivery sorting operations. Could you talk about what interests you and why it's important for processing and distribution?
What we had at that time, Bob, was we had very late deliveries, first-class mail taking 4, 5, 6, 7, more than a week time to be delivered. And so we had a lot of constituents contacting us. And so we wanted to get to the root of the problem. And what we found was the assertion by the Postal Department, yes, we've got a problem, but it's not at the mail delivery end, it's at the processing and distribution plant level. So I visited a number of them in Prince George's County and particularly in Charles County as well, and talked to the supervisors who were running those installations, and they were saying, look, the technology that we have, the machinery that we have, is not up to the task that we have as we get great volumes of increase. I tell people all the time that the Postal Department delivers effectively 99% of the mail. However, they deliver millions of pieces of mail on a regular basis. And if you only have 1%, that's a lot of pieces of mail. And it sounds like a cascade, but they do a good job. However, having said that, what we found out that we really did need to invest more in, and they needed to invest more in technology to allow them to process the mail in a timely fashion and get it to person who actually delivers the mail to your house or to your box.
We have heard a lot from your colleagues recently from both parties and in both the House and the Senate that they're concerned about the future of the Postal Service, specifically about the agency's ability to provide universal service everywhere, every day, every to everyone. As you know, there's a provision in current law that authorizes a public service appropriation to ensure universal service. Yet the last time the Postal Service requested that appropriation was in 1982, the year after you came to Congress. Is it time for the Postal Service to ask for that appropriation, to request that appropriation again?
Bob, let me tell you what I think the governors need to do. They need, and I think many of the postmaster generals have done this. I think the present postmaster general has been pretty candid in unofficial conversations. It's a service. Ben Franklin said and knew that having the ability to communicate with one another, and both from a commercial standpoint and a personal standpoint, was critical. And the Postal Department was established as a service. That's important, that word service. It was not supposed to be necessarily a non-profit business. It was a service with the realization that, frankly, to charge to deliver to a community that has 100 people in would be extraordinarily expensive, but that they needed that service. And therefore, government would not only deliver to where it is efficient to do so, and you can have cost spread over 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 or a million receivers of mail, and therefore amortize the cost of that, but over a small area, very expensive. So it is important to remember that the post office is a government service, not a profit-making service. We've made the post office independent, and we expected it to charge for its services to pay for itself. But we have, of course, the necessity to have those rates approved. And, of course, everybody would like services for free. You know, we'd all like to have things for free, right up until the time we think that, well, that's not a practical thing to do. You can't deliver things for free that we need. And so we have this tension all the time between both the efficiency of the post office, getting it there regularly, and they do, in my opinion, an extraordinary job of delivering the mail, processing the mail. And I think do so in a competitive way with respect to any other mail service in the world, whether it's private or public. And so there is this continuing tension. The public wants a good cost or a low cost for the service. They're correct. We all want that. You mentioned universal service. Universal service and everyday service, essentially except holidays, some significant holidays, and Sundays. So it's really a six-day-a-week service, not a seven-day. But that's controversial as well, because delivering on Saturday also costs money. And we're going to continue to have that tension, because the people need and want the service, but we contain the cost of the service because we want it to be available to people in an affordable at an affordable level. But it's much more expensive now. For one thing, we don't send as many letters. Why don't we send as many letters? Because we send one hell of a lot of texts and emails. So we communicate in a different way, but we still have people living all over the country, some in rural areas, some suburban, some in urban areas, who want to get their bills on paper in the mail. Advertisers want to send advertisements so they can sell products. And, of course, all of us who send first-class mails want that letter to get to our family, to our husband, to our wife, to our sister, brother that lives on the East Coast or West Coast. We want that done efficiently. So the tension is between, is it a service? And if it's a service, do we pay for it out of tax revenues? Or is it a nonprofit business that pays its own expenses?
Interestingly, there is nothing in the statute that even says the Postal Service should act like a business. I mean, we've said that.
Right.
We've also said, and I've been saying this before the 40-some-odd years I've been on Capitol Hill, the Postal Service doesn't get any money, taxpayer dollars, which is technically inaccurate.
Right.
It's mostly accurate, but
mostly
not totally accurate.
We require them to send, to do some things.
Yeah.
And we give...
Overseas ballots.
Overseas ballots, some other
mail
services.
For the blind,
yeah.
And stuff like that.
So what we do is give a relatively small sum to offset are requiring those to be done, in effect, for free.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, we don't give much on the operating costs. They inherited a large tax liability for, not tax liability, but for retirement liability. We've taken some steps on that, but they're still in a hole on those retirement benefits.
I want to dig a little deeper in the concept of an appropriations, because there's some discussion now about cordoning off the public service, the universal service obligation, and saying Congress requires the Postal Service to perform certain tasks, uniform postage, not closing small and rural post offices, six-day mail delivery, which you mentioned. If Congress would consider in some way underwriting partially some of its universal service obligations that it is required to perform, is there a way to cordon off that appropriation from legislative tinkering, like creating new zip codes and issues that the Postal Service might be find serious problems with?
Well, of course, I think no matter what the present law says, the Post Office is subject to legislative direction, to law, to do this, that, or the other. So depending upon whether the majority feels that's appropriate, cordoning off is very tough. So I think it'd be difficult. And you can understand politicians who get, you know, a letter or a call or somebody shows up at their town meeting and say, look, it's taken me six, seven, eight days to get a first-class mail from the next town. What's happening? Well, of course, it doesn't necessarily go from town A to the next-door town B. It goes into a distribution center, is processed, and sent back to the local post office in B's location. So I think it's tough, because as long as you have a service that so many people depend upon and it's not 100% accurate, which none of us are 100% accurate, you're going to have complaints, and representatives are going to get calls, and representatives are going to try to fix it if they can.
I want to mention another issue that is made front page news around the country, and it deals with the Postal Service, and it deals with the presidential executive order impacting vote by mail. Earlier in your career, you shepherded enactment of the bipartisan Help America Vote Act. I think that was in 2002. I'm curious, the executive order, which could suppress votes, vote by mail, what do you think Congress ought to do? What do you think will happen? What do you think of the executive order?
Well, I don't think much of it, and I don't think of the motivation behind it. Ironically, this president voted in the Florida primary by mail. Why did he do it by mail? Because he was not in his home state. In this case, he was in Washington, D.C., wasn't in Florida. That happens to a lot of people. Illness may preclude them from going to the ballot box. There are all sorts of reasons why people can't show up at a ballot box on any given day. The president's assertion that somehow there's something wrong with our election system, I believe, is absolutely wrong. And it is because he could not accept defeat. And he anticipates that he is not going to get the majority of Americans voting for him. And therefore, he's pursuing a policy to try to limit the electorate, try to intimidate the electorate, trying to assure that people he thinks may not be voting for him for whatever reasons do not become either registered or voters. Now, let me say this. Only citizens should be able to vote. Only authorized ages should be able to vote. And the good news for every American is that case after case after case after case, litigation, courts, proof, evidence, cross-examination, America is blessed by having a very, very low level of discrepancies in voting. And very frankly, one of the reasons is, and understandably, we have mostly volunteers running our elections. And they do so out of a sense of public duty. And they get paid a stipend. They don't really get paid for 12, 13, 14, 15, 16-hour day. There is a some people do something wrong. It's done by human beings. That answers your question. There are almost any human endeavor, there are human beings who try to do something that's not consistent with rules. But in our country, over the centuries, we have found that we have a minimal amount of wrongdoing and that it does not rise to the level of having an effect almost in any case on the outcome. But this president would have you believe that almost every voting place in America has corruption. That's false. Not only is it false, but it's dangerous to give to the American people a sense that somehow they cannot rely on their vote being counted and counted accurately for the policy or person that they want.
It would seem that placing the Postal Service in the position of comparing a voting list, a state-developed voting list that has already been vetted by government, a federal agency, places the Postal Service in the position of determining voter eligibility in some respects, and also places the Postal Service in the ability of deeming as unmailable an absentee ballot that is not on the on some list.
You're absolutely right, Bob. And that should not be the case. We ought not to put the Postal Service in that position, and we ought not to put the voters in that position. Absentee ballots, I've voted absentee for a number of times, not all the time, but a number of times, never had a problem. Checked that my vote was counted. Now, they don't know how it went because that's not their information. It's a secret ballot. But they know whether I cast it. So president is not being truthful with the American people. And the president's almost hysterical focus on this issue. I mean, he can't help talking about it. And he's been talking about it for years. And certainly talked about it in 2016. Said really he won the election. Well, he didn't win the election. He won the Electoral College vote and therefore became president because that's our constitutional direction. But Hillary Clinton, quote, winning or losing, got most of the votes, got more votes than the president. Not most of the votes, but more votes than the president. So putting the, frankly, post office in a position of being the arbiter of who can vote or who can't vote is absolutely inconsistent with our Constitution that assures the right to vote, and including the amendments to the Constitution, which said you cannot preclude people from voting, as we did for well over a century.
Last question, Congressman. What's your favorite postage stamp?
I have two favorite. One is John Kennedy, and one is John Lewis.
Great.
And I have both of them in my den at home. And depending upon who I send a letter to, I have a John Kennedy stamp, and it came in a block. I think I have 12 or 20 on a block. And you remind me, I need to get some new ones. I hope they're still making it. And John Lewis is more recent. But John Lewis was one of my best friends in the Congress of the United States. He and I were very, very close. He was a great hero. And in my opinion, one of the two really historic figures that I've served with, one being Nancy Pelosi and one being John Lewis. And maybe we're going to have a third. I think that we're going to win the election in the House, and I think we're going to have an African-American speaker for the first time, and Hakeem Jeffries will join that group of historic Americans that served. But by far, John Kennedy made a great deal of difference in my life. He motivated me. That's why I got into public service. John Lewis, dear friend, made a difference in America.
I want to thank Congressman Steny Hoyer for joining us on this week's NAPS Chat. Thank you so much, Steny.
You bet, Bob. Good to be with you.
And I want to thank NAPS Chat listeners for logging on. If you enjoy NAPS Chat, please leave us a positive review in whatever podcast store you are enrolled in. And more importantly, share NAPS Chat with your friends and colleagues. In the meantime, stay safe and stay healthy.
I'm gonna bend right down and write myself a letter.